Well, I am extremely excited to welcome you all back and to listen to this blockbuster panel. I'm so excited to bring these people here. I believe that, Donald, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think any of these people have actually testified before the commission, or if so, it's been a really, really long time.
I have.
You have? Okay. Well, it's been a really, really long time. This is not the usual suspects for us, which I think is so important for us to hear different perspectives, and what this panel is going to do is to try and bring in some perspectives from different areas of the law. We have on this panel John Coates, who teaches corporate governance and finance at Harvard Law School and Harvard Business School. And before coming to Harvard, he was a partner at the Wall Street law firm Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen, and Katz. So any of the lawyers in the room, we've all heard of Wachtell. So he has seen it from both sides, the academic and the practical side. Robert Jackson is professor of law and co-director of the Ira M. Milstein Center for Global Markets and Corporate Ownership at Columbia Law School. How incredibly relevant to what we're talking about today, where his research emphasizes empirical study of executive compensation and corporate governance matters. Before joining the faculty in 2010, Professor Jackson served as an advisor to senior officials at the Department of the Treasury and in the Office of the Special Master for TARP Executive Compensation. Mace Rosenstein is a partner at Covington & Burling and chair of the firm's media, internet, and telecommunications practice area. His practice is focused on, among other things, what he calls arcane foreign investment limitations under the Communications Act and implementing FCC rules and policy. And my dear old friend Donald Tobin is dean of the University of Maryland Carey School of Law and a former faculty member and associate dean at the renowned Ohio State School of Law, which is so well known for its election law professors and teaching and scholarship. He's also a former Justice Department attorney and former Capitol Hill aide, and has spent his career working at the intersection of election law and tax law. And the purpose of this panel was to try and bring in these experts to help guide us and bring some perspectives from other areas of the law that are not just focused on the FECA, the Federal Election Campaign Act. So we're going to do this in alphabetical order. So Professor Coates, start us off.
Okay, thank you. And thank you very much for the invitation to be in a place I don't usually go, right? So my background, as the introduction alluded, is from the corporate governance and financial market side, and I was blissfully ignorant of and happy to ignore everything that everybody else in this room has spent their careers focusing on until Citizens United. And actually, in fairness, Citizens United did wake me up to something that I think the corporate law community has neglected too, which is the way that corporations have, long before Citizens United, but not going back that far to the 70s, started using the Constitution quite aggressively and opportunistically to deregulate when they lose the lobbying battles that they are very good at fighting. So they get two rounds of regulatory reform, one in the actual regulatory process and another in court, where they're increasingly using the First Amendment to take on greater and greater pieces of the regulatory world, an area that I've written about. But today I'm going to focus principally on a couple of narrow topics, drawing on my teaching and research in the corporate law area, and just to make some basic points about disclosure or its absence of ownership, including foreign ownership, and the fact that in many, many domains, nevertheless, there are longstanding statutes, regulations, legal traditions for treating foreign companies and foreign influenced and control companies quite differently than we treat domestic, and there's nothing particularly surprising or pernicious about that. It's not an embrace of nativism. It's not an embrace of Trump's approach to trade. It's a standard part of the way that every country thinks about regulating business activity in their country. So, as you all probably know, there's no disclosure obligation on companies as such in the U.S. to disclose their political activity. There have been efforts ongoing to try to get the SEC to do something for public companies, but Chevron could spend $1 million into astroturfing currently, and no one would know unless they bragged about it, not even its current owners, right? So that's standard baseline. But there's probably a bigger gap in the disclosure laws that you may not be fully aware of, which is there's no general obligation for a company operating in the U.S. to tell anybody who its owners are. There are more than 5 million active business corporations active enough to file returns with the IRS, and of those, less than 1% are public companies. And even of the public companies essentially have obligations only to disclose the ownership interests of the people currently executive officers or directors of the company, or if they own more than 5%. But again, just want to stress, most companies, including very, very large companies, are not public and not even subject to that disclosure regime. So in sum, if the public wants to know who owns a given company that shows up in any forum as a donor, for example, in the FEC regulatory process, there's no way to find out actually who owns that company under normal disclosure obligations. There are some reporting requirements to specific pieces of the government, I'll come back to that in a second, such as the IRS, but they're generally not available to the public, and they're very carefully circumscribed in how that data can be used. So is this an issue? Is there any reason to think that foreign control of U.S. companies is common? Well, actually, yes. That IRS data I was just alluding to discloses in the most recent update I could find about $12 trillion of assets owned by U.S. companies that were controlled by foreign owners, 51% or more, something like 100,000 such companies with a non-trivial amount of revenue and assets operating in the U.S. One you all know, actually. So you know that Budweiser can you've seen turn into something called America. It's actually owned by a Belgium company in the lovely city of Belgium, as Donald Trump has referred to it recently. Okay. What about less than full control? IRS collects data on full control, controlled companies. There's a separate data regime that the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and the U.S. Treasury run where they survey banks and brokers and issuers, large issuers, to try to figure out how much portfolio investment, that is, non-controlling investment, there is into U.S. corporate stock. And the best data from that is that an astonishing increase, actually, over the past 30 years. Back to 1982, about 5% of all U.S. corporate stock was held or controlled by foreigners. It's now up to 25. Let's let that sink in for a second. So $1 in $4 in value terms in U.S. corporations is controlled directly or indirectly by a foreign owner. Now, what kind of foreign owner? Well, we don't know. It's part of the disclosure gap. They could be individuals, they could be companies, they could be governments. And of course, in many countries like China, governments and businesses are essentially identical. And so a little hard to tease out, even if you know the country from which the investment is coming. The largest single country source in that data, which they report, is the Cayman Islands. Which means basically be anybody, anywhere in the world, since the Cayman Islands are not exactly a location for major independent economic activity. It's really a location for corporate fictional entities to shelter their ownership. Okay. What about elections? Is there any indication that corporations, in fact, are moving into the elections? This is, you've probably already heard about this to some extent on the first panel, but just to pick out a couple things to reiterate if you haven't heard them. Earlier in this presidential cycle, $2.5 million was given to Rubio's single candidate super PAC by a Panamanian company. There you go. We don't know the owners of that company. I know one of them, Hank Greenberg, because I was involved in a litigation involving Star and AIG in which that company figured, but the actual total current composition of the ownership is unknown because it's a private company and there's no obligation to disclose in any forum the owners of that company. There's a company called Children of Israel, LLC, you may have read about in the Washington Post, organized in the U.S. by a Silicon Valley realtor named Lisa Gao, who has no prior history of making political donations herself. Her job, which she markets herself as, is a realtor in the Silicon Valley area, helping PRC Chinese nationals find houses in Silicon Valley. They've given money, that LLC, which she's the president of, has given money to a number of single candidate super PACs. $1 in $8 flowing to the super PACs are now come from corporations, and that, of course, doesn't count dark money, where the principal organized groups are predominantly business corporation members, chamber, business roundtable, etc. Larry Tribe in yesterday's Boston Globe pointed out that Uber and Lyft are now playing a massive and completely unheralded, previously unheralded role in local elections, fighting off local requirements that they get their drivers to have background checks. And finally, and I think actually the thing that's the most troubling from an overall policy perspective are the ghost companies, where, as you probably know, companies spring up within a week, make a $250,000 donation to a single candidate super PAC, and no one has any idea who these companies are, who they're owned by, anything else. They're likely owned by U.S. citizens, just by my guess, on average, but we don't know, and we certainly don't know what's going to be coming down the pike. That path has been laid. Now, just to make my final point, are there precedents for thinking about differentially regulating foreign companies? I mean, obviously, free trade, parity of treatment when it comes to trade and business is a standard part of the ideology, at least traditionally, within both parties and within most of the population if they think about it over time, long and hard enough about it. You know, sometimes we flirt with protectionism, but not in a serious way. However, coinciding with that long tradition of free trade, we have very specific foreign restrictions throughout a number of different industries, just as every country in the world does. So to take the most obvious, defense, you simply can't do business with the Defense Department unless you go through a very specific regulatory approval process, and they won't grant it to many countries because of national security concerns. Infrastructure is another big category, shipping, aircraft, telecom. All of those industries have very strict limits on foreign ownership. Some ban it completely, and some it's regulated through an approval process. And maybe not so obvious, financial services. Now, the crisis hopefully has taught the lesson. The financial markets are a type of crucial public infrastructure, and we regulate foreign ownership in this area. There's a recent deal that fell apart involving an insurance company based in Iowa called Fidelity Life. Angban, a Chinese company, was going to buy them. They announced a deal. The New York Life Insurance Commissioner asked, as is typical, who owns you, the buyer, and that company refused to disclose their ownership, and the deal died over that. It's a multi-billion dollar deal. That company actually owns the Waldorf Astoria, in case any of you are sleeping there anytime soon. You sleeping in a hotel owned by a company that refuses to disclose its ownership to the New York State Life Insurance Company as part of a routine acquisition. Now, one reason probably for the sensitivity of ownership disclosure in that case is that the current chairman is married to a granddaughter of the former chairman of the party in China. And the New York Times has done a little sleuthing around what little disclosure there is in China and has found that two of the shareholders are state-owned enterprises, i.e. they're part of the government of China, and 37 other companies are companies owned by other companies, which in turn are owned by other companies, which are in turn owned by other companies. In other words, you can't trace the ownership in any serious way, probably because it all ultimately traces back to, let's say, economically and politically advantaged descendants of the founders of the party in China, which could be politically embarrassing within China. So that's an example of where we already have, for good reason, an existing skepticism about foreign ownership. There are many. What more fundamental feature of our government is the protection of the republic? Foreign interests and domestic interests are going to predictably diverge. If you're appointing a president, an independent committee chairman, et cetera, to a political system that has oversight of the industries where we ban foreign ownership, it's a little odd then to allow foreign influence to occur at the top of that chain and not further down that chain. That is to say, if the Defense Department can ban somebody from participating in a contract, why would you let people with influence over the contract higher up the chain be influenced through the electoral system by the very same foreign companies? And I will stop there.